it should be working. Okay, ready to go.
Okay.
Now. Okay, and that's ready to go. Okay. What is the date today?
20th, I think.
Okay, yeah. So it's in the middle. Okay, it's March 20th, 2009. Mm-hmm. I'm Emily Weevil, and I'm here with Kaiying Zhang, and I have to spell the names. EmilyWeevil, and Kaiying, KayingZhang, Zhang, XIong. Okay, so I'm ready to go. Okay, kind of the first general questions. What was the date and place of your birth?
I was born on August 23rd, 1972, in Longcheng, Laos.
Okay. What is your race?
That's always a conflicting question, I think, for me. But Asian, and then Hmong is the actual ethnicity.
Okay. Yep, you covered that, ancestry, ethnicity. Mm-hmm. How many male or female siblings do you have?
I have 3 brothers and 5 sisters.
What is your place in the birth order?
I'm second to the oldest.
Second to the oldest, yep. Okay. I'm the oldest child, too.
Okay.
Let's see. The name and occupation of your partner or spouse?
Charles Wu, and he is a student services coordinator with the Multicultural Office at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. Yep. And yeah, I know that you have 3 children.
Mm-hmm.
What are their names and ages?
Andrew is 15, Justin is 12, and Isabella is 9 months old.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Where did you attend school and what degrees have you earned?
Was that including pre-K-12 or just...
That would be interesting.
All right. Well, I've lived in Eau Claire most of my life. When my parents first came to the United States, I attended school in kindergarten through second grade in Wheaton, Illinois. Little suburb, kind of southwest, I think, of Chicago. And then since we moved to Eau Claire, I've had all of my elementary, middle, and high school years here in Eau Claire. And then I went to UW Eau Claire and received my elementary education degree in 96, and then received my administrative degree from Superior in 2001, and then most recently my doctorate from Hamline University in 2007.
Okay. Wow. I hope I can do that. It's going to take me a while.
You can.
Oh, I hope so. Anything else about your general background that you think is important? This is pretty basic stuff, so...
Yeah, well, just kind of like what I'd said before, you know, I've lived in Eau Claire most of my life mm-hmm. after coming here in 1978, and my family is here. Both of my parents are here in town along with most of my siblings, and so... and most of Charles's family is here in Eau Claire as well, so
that's
we have
nice.
Lots of family here in
yeah,
town.
Yeah, that's really great.
It's part of what's kind of kept us, so.
Yeah, I like Eau Claire. It's a nice city. Okay. Describe your relationship with your parents and your siblings when you were growing up.
You know, I had good relationships with my siblings. There were a lot of us, and I think growing up in a home with that many children, you learn to get along very differently than if it were only one or two children in the home.
Mm-hmm.
I know the differences between looking at my own children now when I was growing up is that my children now have things that are, quote, theirs. You know, their toys and their books and
right.
their games. And growing up, we never had anything that was really just ours. I mean, our family just, we shared everything. You know, with 9 children in the family, you shared everything that you had. And the older children were always taught and told to share with the younger kids. And so, you know, if we had something and one of the younger siblings wanted it, we always surrendered to them and because we wanted to keep them happy. That was part of our job was, you know, to make sure that the younger kids were entertained and taken care of and not to be kind of a distraction to my parents. And but I grew up in a very authoritative home. I mean, my father was definitely the head of the household and made all the big decisions and, you know, things that needed to get done. My mother primarily, you know, took care of the household, raised the children, and not to say that my father didn't consult with her, but...
Did she stay at home?
For the most part, yep. She stayed home till, she stayed home till I was a sophomore in high school. And by that time, then, my youngest siblings, the youngest one had started... I think she had either started kindergarten or she was able to be put in a preschool. So, because I remember being a sophomore in high school and after school driving to the daycare to pick them up and bring them home.
Oh my gosh.
Because my mother worked longer hours than, you know, the kids were able to stay at the daycare. So, you know, we just, we everybody helped each other out, and my mom was home for mm-hmm. most of my growing up years. And she really didn't work until I was quite a bit older. So.
Yeah. So being the second oldest, did you have to take care of, it was more of like almost a mother role too.
In a way. You know, we were probably home, you know, especially on weekends, more with the siblings than my parents were.
Yeah.
Just because of other family obligations that took them outside of the home or work or, you know, things that just needed to be done
right.
outside of the home. And so I think they were very comfortable with the idea that my sisters and I can stay home with the younger kids and take good care of them. And we must have done okay because no one got hurt, so.
Everyone's doing well, yeah.
Everyone's doing okay.
That's good. That's really interesting. The community in the neighborhood where you grew up, you grew up here in Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I grew up here in Eau Claire. When we first moved to Eau Claire, we lived down on Hobart Street for several years, and then we moved to Barstow Street, which was a street just right over, parallel to Hobart. And we stayed there till I was a sophomore in high school. Then we moved up here on the northeast, the east side hill is where we lived for the remainder of my high school years. And then I've lived primarily on the south side here for, you know, since I've been married and have raised my children here. So.
Yeah, it's a nice neighborhood.
Yeah.
It is nice. Describe how your family was or was not connected to the community in the neighborhood.
You know, when I was growing up, I can't say that we were real connected to the neighborhood in a sense that in the early 80s, there was a lot of racism and discrimination from neighbors and just people we didn't know. And I think that put my parents in a position where they were very fearful. And so we didn't play outside a lot. We didn't, you know, meet up with our neighbors. We didn't do anything together. It was just we went to school or went to our jobs and then kind of kept to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't real connected with our neighbors that way. In a sense, I feel that we were kind of connected to the community in a way that there was support from the community in terms of, I know my mother used to go up to that, I think it's the Savior's Lutheran Church on Main Street, and, you know, people would bring, you know, used clothing or blankets or pots and pans there, and that's where we would get a lot of stuff that we would use in the house. Or, you know, she'd go to the Parks and Recs for adult classes, adult language classes in the evenings.
Oh, wow.
You know, some things like that. You know, and there were other people outside of our neighborhood that, you know, reached out to us.
Yeah.
And I know when we first came to Eau Claire, us children started going to Calvary Baptist Church, and, you know, people there would bring a little bus and they'd come and pick us up and bring us back home and, you know, things like that. So there was, you know, some community outreach in that sense, but in terms of our immediate neighborhood, we really weren't very connected at all, just because, like I said, there was enough, I think, acts of violence and things like that going on that my parents were really pretty fearful of us doing things outside of the home or, you know, even leaving our front yard sometimes.
Yeah, definitely with little children, too.
Yep.
Wow.
So.
Who had the power and privilege in a community, and how did it affect you and your family?
Well, you know,
kind of a difficult question.
Yeah, well, and I can tell you that growing up, you know, definitely it was very clear to our family that the white people, or, you know, we'd call them anybody that wasn't Hmong, we'd call American people.
Really?
That the American people definitely had the power in the community. And even if it was your neighbor next door that really didn't hold any positions of authority or anything like that, we definitely saw them as the people that held the power because, you know, the understanding was that the country belonged to them and that they had the rights that we didn't have. Just kind of that unconscious understanding of where you were, having grown up in Eau Claire and now working in the community. I think, you know, I have a little bit different twist on, you know, who owns what pieces of the community and, you know, who has an influence. But my parents are still very much under the impression that, you know, the community and the influence of the community belongs to the white man.
Right.
And that he's the person that makes the decision and influences whatever happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's this underlying political thing or a connection going on that most people just aren't privy to, and that it's the white man that runs the show.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. I like this question. What values did you learn from your family and other people and institutions? Mostly probably your family, though.
Okay. You know, from my family, primarily that family comes first. You know, kind of goes back to what I had talked about earlier that, you know, when we were young, it was always, you know, our family came first. You took care of your family before you did anything else. You needed to be happy with your family before you could be happy outside. Or that, you know, if bad things happened in the family, that you kept that in the family, that you worked it out, you dealt with it, that you don't go around telling everybody about those things. And mm-hmm. so family was definitely a value, hard work. My father always believed that we shouldn't be, you know, fooling around, that we should play, even from a very, very young age, yeah. that things should just be very serious. You know, that seriousness comes with, you know, a hardworking ethic and being able to kind of pave your way and get to where you want to be, and that in believing that, there's just no time for play or to have fun. I mean, I didn't go to my first movie until I was probably like a junior in high school, like at a movie theater, because, you know, where my parents came from, going to the theater was seen as a kind of a rowdy act of rebellion against your parents.
Yeah,
you know, kids snuck off and went to the movie theaters, and if you were a good person, you don't do those kinds of things. And so it was just one of those things where, again, my parents really believed that the family came first and that we needed to work hard, that we needed to make sure we got good grades in school.
Yeah.
They saw education really as one of the ways to help us move out of the situation that we were in.
Mm-hmm.
And because both of my parents came to this country as adults with children, they didn't have the opportunity to go to school like what they had seen for us. And so, you know, education was certainly one of the things that they valued greatly, and it was very important to them.
Yeah. Yeah. What occupations did your parents pursue?
My father started working with Hunsinger Farms. Well, actually, back in when we first came to Illinois, he worked in a plastics recycling company. And so it was like, you know, we were in the United States 3 days, and that was a job that our sponsors found for him. And so that was a job that he started doing. Once we moved up here, then he did go to CBTC and got an associate's degree in machine tool. And I'm not sure what the exact title of it is, but it's something to do with machine tool is what it is. And so then he started working with Hunsinger Farms for a couple of years. And then following that position, he ended up with the Eau Claire Housing Authority doing maintenance checks and maintenance jobs for the different housing projects that the city has going for people, for low-income families that live in Eau Claire. And he's been with that job since 1988, 89. So he's been there for a long time.
Yeah.
Yep.
You're after I was born.
Yeah, okay. Yep, and my mother has had a number of different positions as well. She worked with Minnesota Wire and Cable for a little bit, and then worked in a daycare for a little while, and then ended up with also Hunsinger Farms, which is now Silver Spring Gardens.
Okay, so I know
she, Yep, she worked there for a number of years, and then she got real sick with Crohn's disease, and then she had to stop working, and so following that, then she went into retirement. And so my mother hasn't put in quite as many working years, primarily because she didn't start working until I was a sophomore in high school.
Right.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
What role, well, you talked about this before, what role did education play in your life? And I know that was important to your family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you personally?
You know, education has really allowed me to, I think, pursue my career path and to kind of be the person that I think, as a young child, I had imagined being.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, you know, when I was young, it was drilled into my head a lot that, you know, the people who go to school and get good degrees and work hard are the people that are able to afford a home to live in and a car to drive and food for their family and to be able to spend without feeling like, you know, every penny is pinched somewhere.
Right.
And so, you know, having grown up with that mentality, I certainly understand that, you know, the reason why I pursued the different degrees that I have is really because I understand and I can see that education has influenced me a great deal, not only in the aspect of being able to get the material things that I want, but it's definitely opened up my mind and my heart, too, I think, to lots of different things that I wouldn't have thought of, you know, when I was a teenager or growing up in my household or, you know, things that I'm able to do and think about now that I know my mother even to this day would never even imagine doing, you know, things like that. And so it's certainly opened up opportunities for me in terms of just my own personal growth. And my quality of life, I think, you know, has changed tremendously as a result of education.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why I'm in college.
Yeah.
Give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in building your understandings of yourself and society. I know it's kind of a loaded question.
Mm-hmm. You know, and part of the, I think part of why it's difficult for me to answer that question is, first of all, being a minority in a town like Eau Claire, you know, you always just feel inferior, period.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole race, the whole class and gender thing was of minor status. just because race played the major card. You know, I think physically when you look different, and when you have another language and another background that's different
that's
from
a huge factor.
Right, 99% of the people that are around you, that was the one thing that you lived with and believed in and kind of allowed to permeate your life. And so, you know, not that gender and class weren't important, they were very important, especially gender within my own culture, but the whole race thing certainly was very significant in shaping who I am, how I grew up. You know, I think you learn a lot of passive skills when you believe that you're inferior and when you believe that, you know, someone else controls the cards and that you're simply placating to what it is that those people want and that you don't have a say in what it is that needs to change or happen differently.
The power dynamic.
Right, yeah. Right. So that power dynamic, the power structure, I mean, I think in my head growing up was so concrete. You know, there was, I mean, what do you mean you can question the teacher? This is just the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
And part of that, again, is just kind of having it drilled into my head, I think, growing up that, you know, you're a minority in this town. You need to do what the majority want. That's the only way to get along with people is not to get your way, not to challenge authority, you know, not to, even if you don't believe something is the way you want it to be, if the majority of the people are okay with it, that's what you go along with. And so I think having grown up understanding that, you know, it's shaped who I am as an adult, too, because
right.
even to this day, I still find it very difficult to try to rock the boat and to try to not please people, which has been sort of a conflict internally for me, you know, in my position as a principal.
Exactly.
Because I'm not there to keep people happy. I'm there to do the right thing. And sometimes the right thing makes people very upset. And
right.
so that causes me stress, obviously, because of how I was brought up and what I believe in. But
that would be very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you learn, and you learn how to do things to, you know, allow people to believe that even though you disagree, that you can approach it in a tactful way and that
mm-hmm.
you can approach it in a kind way and that just because you disagree doesn't mean you have to butt heads all the time or, you know, be upset with each other. And certainly
right.
emotions and feelings come into play, but I think, you know, the more I'm in the position and I think the older I get, the more you learn to understand that there are ways to come to a problem without feeling like we're offending each other or, you know, allowing the other party to feel like they're not being listened to.
Right.
Well, so that's kind of the race part of it. Certainly gender in the Hmong culture, it's just a very prevalent belief and understanding that the men do control, again, the power cards and that they have the final say in decisions that are made. And that's certainly not true of every single Hmong family, and it's certainly not true of a lot of Hmong individuals now that are probably in their 30s or younger. But again, growing up, you know, I saw that power differential of, you know, the men eat first, the men do this first, the men make the final decision. If your husband says it's not okay for you to do something, you don't do it. You know, and so that whole gender piece certainly was very significant in my life growing up. And even as a married person right now, you know, my husband is very cognizant of that fact, and you know,
mm-hmm.
he's certainly very understanding, and he's not traditional at all in the sense of believing that there's a power structure. But outside of my immediate family here, you know, it's still all over. I mean, it's
Definitely.
Still very prevalent. Like when we get together with his extended family, when we get together with my extended family, it's still the men run the roost and the women do the work to make it happen. And again, you know, I don't want to say that in a bad way, but that's just the dynamics of how things break out, and that's just the common understanding that, you know, if there's a big decision to be made or if something has to be talked about, the men are the ones to discuss it and talk about it first. And the women can certainly provide input, but the decision really isn't theirs in the end.
So, wow. Yeah. That's interesting. What memories do you have of being discriminated against or seeing others who are victims of discrimination?
Well, you know, I have a few memories, and I think it wasn't until years later that you look back and you think, that was discrimination. You know, you just don't see it that way.
Especially when you're younger, too.
Right, right, when you're younger. Because I remember one time standing at outside of Kmart with my mother, and because she didn't drive at the time, we were waiting for the city bus. We were just standing outside of Kmart,
mm-hmm.
waiting for the city bus to come by, and outside of Kmart, there were toys that were on display. And one of the items that were on display was a pink Barbie car, one of those plastic Barbie cars that you can actually pedal around. And my sister was with us, and so she was kind of playing with that. And a lady just drove up, and she said, "You can't touch that because you can't afford it. You know, you don't have any money, and you can't afford it." You know, and at that time it was like, oh, yep, we were doing the wrong thing. We shouldn't have touched it because we knew we weren't going to buy it. But it was years later when I reflected back on that I thought, that was discrimination, you know, because we looked different. I mean, she had no clue who we were and, you know, anything like that. She just drove up in her car and because we were standing there, just started yelling and screaming at us to not touch it.
What did your mother do?
Nothing. She just stood there, which is typically what she always does is, oh, you know, they're right. We shouldn't be touching it. Now they're mad at us. And so, you know, she picked up my sister and we just backed away and waited by closer to the building and away from that item, even though, you know, the person having said what she said had no right to say what she had said. In those days, it was kind of like, well, that's the way it is, though. Remember, that's a white person and we're not white people. And so you don't think about, well, what right does she have to say that to me? I mean, you just don't put yourself there. You know, it's just, oh, they're right. We shouldn't be touching it because, you know, we're not going to buy it and we can't buy it. So
how old were you when that happened?
I probably, because I think I was in eighth grade at the time. So
14, 13,
about 13, 14. 14, yep. Yeah, because I remember I was at DeLong Middle School at that point. So.
Okay. Wow.
That's a memory. You know, another funny thing that I think happened to my husband and I right after we were married, in which, you know, again, when I thought back to it, was really just a discriminatory act of an officer not having enough to do. And, you know, I tend to want to believe that officers are good people and they're trained to do the right thing and they want to do the right thing. But we were driving down Farwell Street and we got pulled over. And when we got pulled over, the cop came up and it was just the two of us, and he came up and he said, what is it that you were eating? And I had a bag of sliced mangoes with me. And so I was taking it out of the bag and giving it to him, and he was eating it. And I said, we're just eating some fruit. And he says, well, from a distance, it looked like you were smoking marijuana. So I just had to check it out. But, I mean, he never checked us out or anything, just peeked in. I showed him the fruit, and then he backed up. And I thought, I don't have a clue what marijuana looks like or how to smoke marijuana, but wow. And so at the moment, that's what it was. And years later, when I thought back to it, I thought, you know, I don't. If that's not an act of discrimination, I don't know what is, because, again, I still don't know what marijuana looks like, but how do you mistake in someone eating a slice of mango for marijuana?
Yeah,
or did he just not have anything
really
to do
bizarre.
And thought, you know, because it wasn't even like you don't have your seatbelts on or your lights are out or you did signal. I mean, it was just, you know, I just want to know what you were doing because it looked like you were smoking marijuana. Now, I don't know if people, you know, prevalently smoke marijuana in their vehicles that way or not. But, you know, again, that was 1992, so that wasn't, you know, like back
in
the
70s
or anything.
No, that wasn't that long ago.
No, that was just in 92, so anyways. So those are the two that kind of stick in my head for whatever reason. There are lots of other things, you know, especially with kids at school, with, you know, the taunts and go back to where you came from or go back to China or, you know, you're chinks or you're gooks or things like that. And those are all things that you learn to ignore and you keep on going and you don't retaliate by saying anything because you learn, I think, at some point that it doesn't pay to, you know, say anything back or right to fight back and that words just can't kill you and you just keep on going. So lots of childhood memories of, you know, being at school and things like that. But, you know, those two examples really are the two that kind of stood out for me.
Yeah, good examples. I can't believe you got pulled over. That's crazy.
Yeah. And then, you know, even like today, you know, feeling, you know, I think there are even still people who wonder if you get the positions that you do because of who you are as a person and, oh, they needed a minority and so you filled that quota, you know, and trying to explain that I wasn't handed the job by any means. I had to interview like everybody else. I had to have the right credentials. You know, it wasn't like any special favor was played by saying, well, you didn't have the degree that was needed, but we'll make an excuse for you. It's, you know, you needed the degree, you needed the years of teaching, and you needed to be at a spot that allowed you to be able to move into that position as well. So,
right.
You know, and I get that not so much from, I think, the adults that I work with, but probably more so from parents that come into the building, you know, who just wonder and, you
know,
where did you come from again, and where did you learn to speak English, and, you know, what degrees do you have, and, you know, where did you learn to be a principal? I mean, stuff like that allow you to just believe that they're questioning your credibility,
right?
And I don't know that they would be asking questions like that if it were a white man in that position.
Exactly.
You know,
they wouldn't.
So, probably not.
They wouldn't. What did you learn from experiencing or witnessing these acts of discrimination?
You know, again, like I said earlier, I think you learn that to move yourself ahead is really the only way to outlive some of those things. And if you continue to perpetuate the notion or the idea that, you know, Hmong people coming to this country stay on welfare, if there's even such a thing anymore, or that you can't help yourself, I think you continue to help perpetuate that image that you can't be helped. And so I think, you know, one of the lessons that I've learned is you have to help yourself because that's the only way to do it. There isn't anyone else out there that's going to help you. And if you don't work hard and if you don't push yourself, you're not going to get to a different place. And therefore, people will have the right to call you what they want and to do what they want. But it's only when you're on an equal playing field in terms of holding a job, being able to pay taxes, and those types of things, will you be economically on equal footing. And I think economics drives a lot of what people do and say. And so I think, you know, from those things you learn again that words don't hurt and that you just have to be able to turn the other cheek and do it without being violent, because if you, you know, violence is not the way to answer anything. Mm-hmm. And I think then growing up you start learning too that even though you're not in acts of, you know, discrimination all the time, you know, when things go wrong, it doesn't call for violence. That words can, you can work things through words and kind of go from there.
Yeah, that's good. Describe any efforts you've witnessed or participated in to confront discrimination. What tactics or strategies were used? Which you kind of covered.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when we were younger, probably the only thing we knew was just to back away and not retaliate, you know, when we were younger. As you get older, you know, the one thing I've learned is not so much to be in people's faces and to tell them that what they've done is wrong, because that's especially as adults, that's the first thing that will, you know, what they want to do is, yeah, whatever, and then walk away. And I think one of the things that has been helpful for me has been to ask people questions. You know, when you hear them say things or do things that aren't appropriate, you know, to question them, how do you know that and why did you say that? Or, you know, how did you help the situation by doing what you've done? I mean, just by asking people questions and allowing them to think. And I think, you know, most people are well-intentioned and well-meaning, and I think once they think that through, then perhaps they're able to come to their own conclusions about why they do what they do instead of someone saying to them, that's wrong, don't ever do it again. But now that you've allowed them to think about it, maybe they've been able to come up with their own opportunity to understand why they've done what they've done and perhaps why it's not okay that way.
Right.
So I find that, you know, just asking people questions is a good way to go about just challenging some of their thoughts and myths and beliefs too. But having said that, I'm not very good at it either. You know, I mean, it's just one of those things.
It's hard.
It's very hard. It's very hard to be assertive. And I think, you know, whether it be at work or wherever you're at, there's a certain part of you that says, I have to get along with these people and I need to be liked by them in order to be successful. So whether I prefer that or not, it really doesn't matter, because again, the bottom line is, I need to work with these people, so
right.
I have to be tactful about it, and it has to be, the timing has to be right. You can't just start challenging people all the time either, because that's really a very easy way to turn people away from wanting to be with you too. So
that's very true. Yeah. Good point. What significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood, and how have they affected you throughout your lifetime? Just kind of a hard one. Anything specific?
Yep. And you know, really, you know, we left Laos when I was 3, so I don't remember a whole lot, you know, from that at all. And then we lived in Thailand for another 3 years, and left there when I was about 6. So, I mean, in terms of historical events, gosh, I just, you know, I missed a lot of the big ones in this country. By the time I got here, you know, Martin Luther King was gone and Kennedy was gone, and yet those are the things that we heard a lot about once we came to the United States, but it wasn't so much a historical thing that I was around to see, because we weren't here in the country. So I'm not sure. I guess I'm not sure in terms
That's
of just thinking
question.
About, yeah, I haven't thought about that too often, so.
What year did you first, this I had a couple of just side notes, what year did you come to the U.S.?
1978. Yeah, June of 1978.
And you were, how old were you?
6.
My gosh. Yeah. Looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist later in life?
Probably not, and I don't know that I would call myself a feminist.
That's a strong word.
It is a strong term, and I think it just probably rubs some people the wrong way, especially when they don't understand, you know, the intentions of what feminism is about. And especially, I think, if you haven't lived through the oppression that perhaps a lot of cultures have, you know, growing up in the Hmong culture, I think, you know, if I were to say I was a feminist, I think I'd turn all the men away, just because to them, feminism means Hmong women who don't get married, Hmong women who live by themselves, Hmong women who take a stand and argue with men all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the image that they see in their heads, I think, for a lot of them.
A lot of people.
Yeah, so, and I don't know about other people, but I know that in the Hmong culture, for sure, if I were to declare that I was a feminist, I think that's heads would be turning in not in a good way.
Yeah.
And again, I have to live with my people and I have to get along with them, so I try not to be, you know, that radical about it, but... certainly, I think that part of who I am and what I've done allows me to not say I'm a feminist, but to be one without rubbing in people's faces.
Exactly.
You know, to be that example that says, this is how you can do it, and you don't have to alienate, you know, half of the people in your family or in your clan or your culture to be there. And so I think it's just so important that we allow the actions to do the work and not the words.
Right.
Because I think then when people see that you do good things and that being a feminist doesn't mean you run out and bash men all the time, yeah. that it's okay, you
right.
know? And I think in that sense, then that helps other Hmong girls and women too to say, you know, just because we do these things doesn't mean we're men bashing women.
Right.
You know, that it's okay because we see that Kaying is doing it and it's okay and it's worked for her family. You know,
mm-hmm.
she's working outside of the home, she's got a job. She can raise her family, and,
right.
and she's living a happy, relatively happy life. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's important, too, as that aspect of being a good role model for other younger Hmong women and girls as well. So.
Yeah, you don't need the label.
No.
I know, it's an interesting
and
word.
It is, and I think, again, it's simply because there are so many who don't understand that makes that label what it is.
Right.
But truly, you know, I think if everybody were on the same playing field, it wouldn't be an issue at all.
Right. No, that's very true. What else would you like to share about your childhood experiences, if anything?
Well, I think we've talked a lot already about growing up. You know, we were, we certainly weren't poor, but we certainly were not, you know, a middle-class family either.
Mm-hmm.
For many, many years, my father worked, was the only person who worked outside of the home. And yet, you know, we never... there was never a time when we didn't have food. You know, we always had a home to live in, and we mm-hmm. always had food to eat. We didn't have a lot of new clothes. We didn't have a lot of the latest fashions and things like that. But in those days, it didn't bother me as much either. And I think it's when you live with a lot of people like that, then there isn't that peer pressure to be
you don't
different.
See it.
Right. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I started realizing, you know, I wanted the kinds of jeans that my friends had, or I wanted the shoes that my friends had, or I wanted a matching purse with the outfits that I had, you know.
Yeah.
And yet that was just a desire. I never asked for them simply because I knew my parents couldn't provide it.
Right.
And I just had this understanding that they were working very hard to provide for a family, and that those other things that I had wanted were just desires, but that they're not necessities,
mm-hmm.
and that our family was just working off of necessities. You know, nobody was being frivolous with money. I mean, everything
right.
was very tight and... So in that sense, you know, I think I learned to be frugal, too, as I got older, and I learned kind of the meaning of what it means to have money and not to have money and what you can do with money. You know, I try to share that with my own children. It doesn't work very well when you are able to provide for them things that you never had, you know, yourself as a child. But that and then, like, it really, you know, we had good years here in Eau Claire, and I don't want to paint the picture that they were horrible years.
Right.
We've had good years. Met up with good people in the community that were very willing to lend a hand and to teach and share things with us that we normally wouldn't have known
right.
Had we just kept with our own families. So I had good growing up years here in Eau Claire, but they weren't easy years. They weren't easy years in the sense that, again, only my father was working. We lived in a rather impoverished part of town for many years. And yet schooling was kind of that beacon of light that, you know, when we got to school, the teachers would be there to help us.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be there to... kind of protect us if somebody were mean. I mean, we can tell a teacher in the building and they would do something about it, versus when you're in the community or when you're at home, it's kind of like if someone's mean to you, who do you tell? You know, you can
right.
tell your parents because they're the ones who say, don't say anything about it,
exactly.
don't even breathe the fact that somebody was mean to you, because that would just allow them to have the power to do more things. There's nobody to tell, and so school was almost a kind of that light of hope for us when we would show up at school and have a teacher listen or,
right.
you know, hear a principal say to somebody, that's not okay, don't ever do that again. You know, that was very comforting. Yeah, it was very comforting for to be in that kind of environment. And that's not to say there weren't bullies at school and people that were mean to us either, but I think that, you know, as a child, you just feel like, well, they can be mean to me if they want, but I know that it's not okay with my teacher.
Right.
And there's just that comforting sense of hope there that
I remember that
you just know. Yeah. So.
Can you remember a favorite teacher that you had?
Well, I can. And, you know, really all of my favorite teachers came from my elementary years. I think just the nature of the way high school and middle school are set up. It's hard to have a favorite person, you know, when you're not with them all day long. But my favorite teacher, actually, I had two teachers. Carol Skornica, who's still teaching right now at Lakeshore, was my third grade teacher, and I adored her a great deal, and I think part of the reason why I became so connected with her is just the fact that she gave me the opportunity to share about who I was, to write autobiographies and to share them with the rest of the class, and to me it was just a story of who I am, but to my class it was kind of something like out of an Indiana Jones movie, you know, when you talk about moving and the places you've been
and
those kinds of things. And I think she, because she allowed me that opportunity, it helped me also connect myself to the rest of the classroom, as well as to see that she valued who I was as a person, even though I was different. And I think that was really kind of the first time that I got the message, it's okay to be different.
Yeah.
Because before that, again, it was always just, you want to be as much like them as possible. You know, don't speak Hmong, speak English, act like them. You know, if you do things at home that are just unique to your culture, don't share things like that because then they'll think you're weird, you know, or just kind of an oddball. And so really being in third grade was one of the first glimpses that I got of, it's okay to be Hmong. You know, it's okay to be a little different.
Yeah.
And then Peggy Buckley was my second grade teacher, and she was the first teacher that I had upon arriving in Eau Claire, and just was very kind and very generous and just very willing to spend time above and beyond, you know, the classroom day.
Was that at Lakeshore as well?
That was at, actually that was both, that was at Randall.
Okay.
Because Lakeshore is a newer school. Randall is, it's the apartments now that are on 5th.
Is that 5th?
Yep. That tall building, Mogison owns that building. That used to be Randall's school.
That's where my house,
yep.
Wow.
That's where I went to school.
Wow.
Yep, for second, third. And then they moved us to Lincoln, which is now the Montessori site on Cameron Street, for fourth and fifth grade. And then I ended up at DeLong. So, but yep, Lakeshore now replaced Randall many years ago. So.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, I didn't know it was a school that recently.
Yep. It was,
yep. Hasn't been.
And actually, I think Lakeshore was only built, I want to say, 90. It was built shortly before I became a principal, which was 2001. So I want to say like 98, 99. Lakeshore isn't real old.
Yeah, that's
it's a fairly new school.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, change the tape. I was watching that. I knew it was going to happen. Just didn't know when. How do I do it?
Is there an eject button?
I'll just use my fingernail.
Well, it works.
Yeah, so then I'm just going to use the empty because that makes me fit. So you went from Laos to Thailand?
Mm-hmm.
Was that just because of the... Why was that?
Well, when we actually left Laos, you know, it was a country in huge turmoil because of the Vietnam War. And so there was no cars or planes or anything to get anywhere. And Thailand was just the closest. So many, many families just crossed the river from the side of Laos to get into Thailand. And it was really just a refugee camp that was willing to take refugees from the war for those couple of years. And so that's how we ended up there. But, yeah, I would say 99% of the Hmong families living in the U.S. right now lived in Thailand before coming to the United States, because you fled Laos and then went into Thailand, and then from Thailand applied for paperwork to come to the U.S. or France or Australia, but nobody went right from Laos to another country. It was right to Thailand. So.
Wow. We kind of talked about this a little bit before, but describe your educational path after high school.
Well, in high school, I kind of knew that I wanted to be a teacher. You know, I enjoyed elementary school a great deal and kind of had that inkling that I wanted to go there. And so after high school, I was in the, I don't know if you're familiar with the EIP program. It's called
Early
Identification Program. It's a program that actually comes from the state. The state gives money so that people can run those types of programs, and it's to identify people, people of color primarily, mm-hmm. or low-income families, because there are some, you know, Caucasian students in the program as well, people whose parents have not had a post-secondary education. And so they identified students such as that, and then through that program, we were able to visit different colleges and talk about different career paths, you know, just with people.
Right.
They'd bring us together for different activities and talk to us about those things and get us to different colleges to visit. And so through that program, you know, I went to a number of different colleges, but being who I was at the time and growing up in a family that I grew up in, you know, my parents were just very worried about me leaving town and going off somewhere, and I was very worried myself about leaving town, and so I did not want to go anywhere far either. And so, you know, and I knew that Eau Claire had a good education program at the time because that's what I had heard from, you
right.
know, the program when we visited the number of times. And so I really, you know, knew that I was going to go to college, and so from high school I went right to UW Eau Claire and got my undergrad degree there. And then from there I got a job at Lincoln and started teaching. So it just kind of happened, you know, that I think I was in the right time at the right place in the
yeah.
right profession. And so I started teaching there, and then from there got the principal job, and in between went to school those years. And so,
yeah.
And I knew that eventually I wanted a doctorate in education. It was just a matter of when it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I continued to teach and work, and then when I became a principal, realized that this was the time and I needed to go back and get some work done. And so
yeah.
I did. And my,
here you are.
Yeah, here I am. My educational path has been really very rewarding and relatively easy, in a sense that, you know, I always felt like I had the right supports in place. And
yeah,
it's just a matter of me getting up and getting to class and doing
yeah.
the homework and, you know, getting through the classes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
When and how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, and other layers of identity?
Oh, and you know, again, you know, that's one of those questions that just has many layers to peel
yeah.
back. You know, it's kind of like that onion that you just, you know, once you peel back one layer, you realize there's a whole other layer underneath that. Growing up in a Hmong family, I think even by the time I was in elementary school, middle school, I saw the inequities just within the whole gender piece, you know, just mm-hmm. within the Hmong family. Again, because I saw that, you know, whenever there was a gathering or a large function, the men always ate first, and then the women ate after the men were done, or that the women did all the work to prepare everything. And the men did some too, but it was primarily the women who, you know, did the housework to get things put together. So even at that point, I remember thinking, I wish I was born a boy, because I hate being
yeah.
this girl. You know, you
yeah.
get directed everywhere, and you get told, you know, what to do and how to do it, and you can't ever say anything because nobody listens to you anyways. And
mm-hmm.
and so in middle school, I remember thinking, I wish I was born a boy. You know, I don't like this role of being a Hmong girl. It just seems so unfair.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like boys can go out and play volleyball every afternoon at Mount Simon if they wanted to, and of course us girls can never go because good girls don't do things like that. You know, and so I remember just being real resentful and almost bitter about being who I was during those times, just because of that whole gender piece, you know, and knowing, and it wasn't just my family, but it was all Hmong families who were treating their girls that way in the early 80s.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was just the way
There's
it was.
No escaping it.
Right, there isn't. And it's not like if you go to, you know, my friend's house, it would be different. You know, it was very similar at her house as well. And so I just remember thinking, oh, this girl thing is not good. You know, I wish I was a boy. And I think by the time I was almost done with high school, I just started understanding how to navigate the system so that even though you're a girl, you don't feel like you're downtrodden on all the time, you know, that or that you're just always the person to do all the work for everybody else. You learn to kind of navigate that system and make yourself useful in a sense that you want to be made useful, and also to be assertive enough so that you do get your voice heard. And I think, again, part of that was really just working hard to show my parents and my relatives that I was a good person, and that even though I'm a girl, I had good ideas to share, and that I had good opinions, and
right.
that it wasn't, you know, just, it's not just foolish thoughts, because I'm sure that's just the belief, is that, you know, girls just have foolish thoughts and they shouldn't talk, you know, but that, you know, working hard all those years to not act supposedly foolish and
right.
and to not, you know, be begging for things that aren't mine, I think to kind of live through that and understand that part of it then also helped people on the other side see that, you know, it's okay. You know, she's kind of proven herself and she's done okay. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until I was in high school that I think I started realizing how I could navigate the system to make it work for me and not to always feel like I was the victim of being told what to do. And again, you know, the whole race card thing, you know, we've always just, you know, since we left Thailand, have been in a place where we've always been the minority. And I think when you grow up, you know, most of your life always being a minority, there are just certain things you learn to accept. Mm-hmm. And that, again, being the fact that when people make racial slurs or, you know, aren't so kind to you, you just kind of take it with a grain of salt and you keep moving on, that you don't retaliate, you don't get angry, or that you don't fight back because it just, there's no point in doing so. Right. There's no point in doing so. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, that works. Totally works. There's a lot to that question. Tons of different words. What memories do you have of your first encounters with a feminist or the subject of feminism?
What encounters? You know, I'm not sure that I can remember anything off the top of my head now. I just, like I said, I just remember thinking, you know, if I'm going to change this way of thinking with my own family, I'm going to have to do something. I'm not going to say I'm a feminist. I'm not going to say the ways of our men are wrong, but that I'm just going to have to do something about it. And that was probably about when I was in high school.
Okay.
You know, and doing something about it again, meaning
I
just...
Going to college.
Right. I'd have to go to college, earn a living, and just prove through doing that it's okay to be a strong-willed woman. Mm-hmm. It's okay to have thoughts and opinions. It's okay to work outside of the home.
Right.
It's okay to earn more money than your husband. You know, I mean, it's just one of those things where it kind of just hits you, and then you think, okay, so if I continue to use my words, I probably will continue to offend the people around me, and so I'm just going to have to start to do something mm-hmm. about it. And so probably about high school, I would say, is okay. when that occurred.
Yeah, that answers that question. What experiences, social movements or events or people were important in shaping you as a feminist? Like any specific people in your life or that guided you?
You know, I'd have to say my mother, being who she is, she rarely asserted herself, you know, with men around. I mean, she'd assert herself with us children. But I think, you know, part of her knew, too, that for us to be able to make it in this country, that we'd have to be very different than her. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result of that, she stayed home all those years to make sure that we had, you know, food on the table every single day, that the only thing we should worry about is going to school, and that she would take care of the rest. And so I think that was an influential part of who I was, is just having my parents there, and especially my mother to, you know, make sure there was a meal waiting for us when we got home from school, and that breakfast was ready for us before we left for school. Mm-hmm. You know, just those basic things that I just think are so critical to a child growing up.
Definitely.
You know, that so many kids don't have these days, and now when I look back, I always think, you know, so we didn't have a lot of money. And my mother never worked outside of the home until I was a sophomore in high school, but it was because, first of all, there were so many of us, and secondly, she just knew that in order for us to do well at school, we needed that stability at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, that we needed to come home to a mother, and that we needed to come home to food on the table, and she did that for us. And so I think, you know, she played that influential role of being able to allow me to see that, you know, even though she can't be who she really probably truly wants to be because of her lack of education and because of the culture and society that she grew up in, that there's potential and there's hope for the rest of us and that it would be okay, mm-hmm. you know, for us to pursue our paths that way. Outside of my mother, you know, my father was very much a very authoritative kind of a man, and yet he was also the person that put his foot down when it came to education. I mean, that was just first. That was what you did. And if you wanted to get ahead, that was what you did. And I think in his mind, even though getting ahead doesn't necessarily mean trumping men, you know, a woman over men, it really meant also, too, that the whole economics piece would come into play, and that until you can show yourself that way, that there wasn't any point in you saying you were a feminist. So in that sense, you know, my father, I think, was a very strong advocate of education and of really working hard and going out there and earn for yourself what it is mm-hmm. that you want. Outside of that, you know, I did have a number of teachers and adults, and including people like Catherine. I met Catherine when I was at Eau Claire doing my graduate work in administration. There was a class that I had to take, and I can't remember what class that was anymore. But anyways, a superior offered it, but, you know, the distance from here to superior is quite a ways, and so wherever there were classes at Eau Claire that I could take, I would pick up those classes, and I took a class with Catherine, and, you know, she was just very influential in my life, just in the sense that, you know, Catherine had a doctorate, and you know she's had many, many years of experience, mm-hmm. and you know she's just so good at what she does, but she can also bring it to your level and be, you know, who the rest of us are in that classroom too, you know, and just being able to share her own knowledge about what it is that we're doing or reading about. You know, I looked at that and I just kind of thought that, but that's the kind of person I want to be. You know, I want to be a person who's wise and has a lot of knowledge, but I also don't want to be looked upon as a person who is ignorant or, you know, kind of stuck up because you have that kind of knowledge. I want to be able to work with the people that I know and be able to share with, you know, others.
Right.
You know, the information, the knowledge that I have too. And so that, you know, she was just very influential to me in that sense, and that she was just so kind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just, with Catherine, you couldn't do anything wrong. Because if you made a mistake,
I get it.
Here's how we can do it again.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just, and that's, we just need so many more people like that. Because I think there are too many the other direction of, you know, this is the way it's got to be done. And,
right.
You know, I'm the one who has the doctorate and I'm the teacher and therefore this is the way it is.
Yeah.
And that's just so not Catherine. So certainly at the university level, she really was very influential with mm-hmm. me. Even at the graduate level, it was just, wow, you know, I want to be kind and considerate
right.
and thoughtful that way. And I want to give of my time to people who I know need that service too.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I love Catherine. She's fabulous. She's a great professor.
She is.
Let's see. What resistance, and you kind of talked about this before too, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you became a feminist? And once again, I think you kind of covered that one, actually. The labeling, but you're not.
Yeah.
That's totally, I understand that. Let's see. Describe the process you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist, but I guess when I say feminist, like do you know what I mean? I understand the conflict there, mm-hmm. the labeling mm-hmm. issue. But I guess, how can I word that? Is there anything that stands out to you? It's kind of a weird question.
Yeah. And you know, I think really with that question, it probably is more conflicting for me as among women than it is in the outside world. Because
mm-hmm.
I think the outside world has accepted so many more women in leadership positions and so many more women who give up their opinions and their
right.
thoughts, you know, who aren't afraid to do so. And so I think within my culture is where I get the most conflict because, you know, when there's a group of men talking or sharing a thought or an idea and they're wondering what to do next, and I feel like, well, I should share this. But a part of me also holds that part back and saying, but it's not your place because
right.
nobody asked you to share your thoughts. And so I guess if I were a strong enough feminist, I'd say, guess what, guys, this is what I think too.
That's
but
hard, though.
It is hard, and because I don't think I'm quite there yet, like sometimes I'll just tell my husband and say, well, you can say this.
Yeah.
And then he'll share that thought, but for me to just interject myself into a group of men having a conversation, I mean, it rarely happens even today.
Right.
Rarely happens, and so, you know, there's a bit of a conflict, I think, internally with me and my own self and my own culture in
right.
that sense.
That's understandable. I don't want to be comfortable doing that either. That's like 5 or 6 more.
Okay.
Feminism has been described as a river with many tributaries. Mm-hmm. In other words, although feminists are united by some common beliefs, they understand and express those beliefs differently.
Mm-hmm.
How do you describe the tributary of feminism that best fits your beliefs?
Well, you know, I think it's just really the whole idea of what we had kind of talked about earlier, being assertive enough without being aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a fine line there. And I think it's really, again, doing more and saying less. You know, if you truly believe you're a feminist, you do things that support women's causes, and you do things that elevate women to a different status.
Mm-hmm.
You do things that show that women have worth. You know, and that's, again, supporting any number of causes or doing any number of different things. But I do think that, you know, if I were to look at the, you know, the tributary, mine would just really be down the path of doing more to show what it is you believe in and what you stand
right.
for, and less talking about what you want to do or what you stand for.
Yeah.
And then I think in doing those things, again, I think most people are well-intentioned people and that they're going to start to see feminism isn't a bad thing.
No.
As a matter of fact, when you elevate women to the same status as many men have, it just allows all of us to do better things,
mm-hmm.
better work, better ideas.
Right.
You know, and it allows us to truly collaborate instead of just being told what to do or you know, what to hear, but that we truly collaborate on our ideas and our thoughts, and that together that makes everything that much better.
Mm-hmm.
But the other party has to be willing to accept that. And again, I think for them to accept that, they're going to have to see through actions, things that have been done from my perspective personally, from yours, you know, from all of us as women who believe that we need to be elevated to a different level than
right.
where our mothers were and, you know, where we currently are at. So
mm-hmm. I like the doing more with saying less. I really mm-hmm. like that. Which kind of goes along with the next question, actually. Mm-hmm. What meaning does the feminist statement, the personal is political, hold for you?
and I think, you know, when I think about the personal,
this is more like an activist.
Right, right.
Guns blaring.
Yeah. And yet I think that, you know, everything is political. I mean, even within families,
mm-hmm.
you know, we advocate and we vouch for things that are important to us. And so I think when we say things like that, it is political in that sense, in that, you know, if something is being done that I think would support women and would help just even one woman get to a different spot, I think that's something that I would support and do, just because, again, it's political. If I don't step in and do that small piece of it, then someone else is going to step in and advocate that the men get to do this, or that the men get that piece of the pie, and then we're done. And so I think, you know, with the belief that everything is political, it's just important to know that there are lots of underlying currents that I think sometimes we miss altogether.
Yeah.
And, you know, just a case in point is, you know, I try very hard to, for my mother, my father does a lot of traveling simply because he has a lot of relatives and he's called on to go to a lot of different functions and things. And I always encourage my mother to go with him. And, oh, she always says, no. You know, they only invited your father and, you know, I should stay home because I need to tend to this and that. And I always say to her, your place isn't always here. You know, you have a place at all of those functions too, but if you continue to never show up, people are going to start to believe that you don't have a place and that you don't know what to do when you go to those functions and things. And so you do have to leave the house and you do have to go, you know, and
what
you
does
do
she
have
say to.
She does go sometimes, but it takes some coaxing, you know,
yeah.
It takes some just kind of getting her out of the house. And you do have to be dressed for, you know, what other people are doing. I mean, you can't just continue to wear your same thing and be your same person
mm-hmm.
because you're comfortable in the home. And because
right.
for so long that's her role, I think she's just come to believe that that's what makes everybody happy. And it's not true, because my father would very much like her to come with.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and yet, again, the politics of that is that if I wasn't right there encouraging her to go and to do so, it'd just be so easy for her to continue to remain where she was.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody else saying, yep, that's her spot, that's her place, because she never leaves. I mean, that's just what it is for her.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. How have you negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations for femininity or masculinity, which I don't know why that's in there, but...
Yeah. So how have I constrained or
How have you negotiated,
negotiated and balanced
your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations?
Okay, yep. And, you know, as we had talked about, there are huge constraining cultural expectations
mm-hmm.
for being among women. Again, how I've negotiated that is I've just really learned along the way that you know, when it's appropriate for me to assert myself, I need to do so. And yet there are lots of times and places where it's not appropriate for me to assert myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just need to be very careful of when those times and places are, so that, again, A, I don't offend anyone, but that B, I don't make my husband to look like somebody who has no control over his wife either.
Right.
You know, and that has nothing to do with feminism, but I think out of respect as spouses, you know, you feel so personally responsible for things that your husband says, and your husband feels responsible for things that you say. And
right.
so I think that's kind of a fine line there, and so I think I just need to be very careful as to when is it appropriate for me to assert myself without, you know, making my husband feel like, oh, that wasn't the right thing to do or say, and hurting him that way, or allowing other people to believe that, again, that he just has no control over what I do and say. But I think part of that negotiations, again, is knowing the right time and place, and again, just really understanding that it's more about doing and not just saying. When people
right.
see that you can do something and do it well,
speaks much louder.
Yeah, then they're okay with it. It's
mm-hmm.
when you talk and they have that doubt that you can do something because they've never seen you do it, that I think they worry and that they, you know, start to interject their own feelings and thoughts. But again, I think, you know, people can see that you can do things and do them well and it hasn't hurt anybody, then they're okay.
right.
You know,
right.
but it's that trust that has to be built in that process and that rapport that has to be built, even with Hmong people. You know, a lot of it is, let me see what you can do first and then I'll... You can make a believer in me after I see what you've done.
Right.
So.
What have been the greatest challenges that you have faced as a feminist?
Mm-hmm.
But
well, I think, again, the challenges are probably just that internal piece of, you know, being within my own culture and my own family. You know, sometimes wishing and feeling like if I were a man, I would say it very differently, or
right.
it would look very differently. And that's just, that's just not the case. So
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's, again, back to my own family. Like I said, sometimes I almost feel like being out in the outside world is easier in a feminist sense, just
right.
because the outside world has a broader and better understanding, in my opinion, than my own culture does. So, just still some internal things there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Which of your contributions have made the greatest difference in shaping feminist theories and practices and your own understanding of yourself?
Gosh, you know, and I don't know so much about a contribution, because I don't feel like I've made, you know, a very significant contribution, really to the greater cause of the idea of feminism. I think it's really just
being your own.
Yeah, and I think for me it probably is just more about, you know, the work that I've done, the education that I've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
I think, again, to be a feminist, you have to have some knowledge. And to have
right.
knowledge, you go to school. And not that education only comes through formal, you know, ways of schooling, but I think having gone to a liberal arts, you know, college, and
mm-hmm.
Having, you know, gone through the administrative tracks, those are things that I think that I have done that, particularly for other Hmong women, can be enlightening. I mean, they can see that as a, if she can do it, we can too.
Right.
And that it's just kind of a modeling aspect of, again, not saying I'm a feminist, but working towards saying we can be on an equal footing with men if we work hard and if we pursue the things that we really want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I think it's really, again, more towards that. The contribution would be working hard to be where I am and to continue to not offend the other side by just being who I am either.
Right.
You know, to walk that fine line and, again, allow other people, both men and women, to see that it's okay to be a strong-headed woman.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
It's okay to have your own opinions.
Yeah, that's a good answer. What do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the past 25 years?
The past 25 years, wow. You know, I really think that, you know, and I'm not very well versed in history, but the whole idea of women working outside of the home, I think, has been a huge and a significant contribution to feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, until women step outside of their homes, all of their good thoughts and ideas are kept behind closed doors. And so once they've actually gone out into the work field, whether it be an assembly job or a professional job or whatever it is that they're doing, they're making contributions to a very man-like world. And so because they've made those contributions, I think that's really what's opened the door to so many more of us doing what we can do, saying we're feminist, you know, sharing our ideas and our thoughts and sitting in a classroom with a bunch of boys and feeling
yeah.
like you're on an equal footing with them.
Right.
You know, because I think had women not left their homes and gone out into the workforce in that kind of a situation, I think we'd still be kind of under the same umbrella of, you know, only the men work outside of the home. And I really believe that that's really why men were elevated to different status once upon a time, because they were the ones who got out, saw, heard, did,
yeah.
right, experienced the things that many women just didn't do because they were behind closed doors and
mm-hmm.
raising their families all the time. So I think that really opened up the door to many more of us having the same opportunities that we have now. And
yeah.
So I think that's really very significant. I'm sure they've done many other things, but like
no,
I said, I'm not real well versed in history,
though.
So
well, that
that's
is
the
a huge
piece
one.
That I would see.
Yeah. Last question, I think. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the most important challenges feminism must overcome in this century?
Well, I really think that, you know, just from my perspective, one of the things that needs to be overcome is, again, just being able to work through that connotation that feminism is a bad thing. You know, and having said that, it involves working with males. It involves working with other women who think that being a feminist is a bad thing. And I think it's, you know, we have to show the other side of what it means to be a feminist, what contributions we can provide and give if we're able to be on an equal footing with men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think that's easy to do because we have a lot of women who are battling the whole notion of feminism, too. You know, a lot of women, I think, are scared of, well, I don't want to say that, or I don't want to act like
right.
that, because then I'll offend other people and turn away the important men in my life. But I think it's, again, through that whole modeling process and through doing that's going to get us to a different place. Mm-hmm. And I think the contributions, as we lay them out, that have come about because women were willing to declare, I'm a feminist, and this is important to me, and I'm going to work for it, and how that's benefited all women and not just the group of women fighting for it, mm-hmm. I think it will make a big difference. And
yeah.
I think it'll be able to help all the women, too, and the men who are kind of reluctant to go in that direction.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I'm sure lots of other things that could be done.
Yeah, but you could write a book on some of these questions. You really right. could. I guess one more. With your daughter, you just had mm-hmm. your daughter. Mm-hmm. As a woman and as she grows up, mm-hmm. what do you want for her?
Well, I would want for her the same things that I would want for my boys. Mm-hmm. I would want to raise her and teach her the same values and the same things that I'm trying to teach to my boys. Mm-hmm. I certainly hope for her a world that she can step into and that people wouldn't say, you can't do that because you're a woman. That she would be able, if she, you know, has the right credentials and works hard, to be able to do any job that any man steps into. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, it's exciting to have a little girl, because with having the two teenage boys, as you know, I see their lives as much easier than mine, in a sense because they're boys.
Right.
In a sense because their father and I are at a different place than my parents were at and his parents were at.
Right.
And so I see their life as just being very different and in a way almost easier than what I grew up with. But every generation has their challenges. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, I would just hope that I would want for my daughter the same things that I would want for my son.
Yeah, that's true.
And hopefully a spouse that cares about the same things,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's a tough part.
Yeah, finding that person is
yeah,
tough.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, I think this is all kind of, yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're very welcome. I hope you're able to transcribe that correctly and accurately. And
I think so. These little old ladies do it. They're volunteers. And okay. Because we don't, no one uses this technology anymore.
Right.
So they do this as like
pedal machines.
Yeah, which is crazy. I don't know how you'd lose your mind.